would be worth the risk that you take?
Cephalo has nothing to do with it, Will replied quietly.
If he has threatened you in any way, I would stand with you against him, the girl declared firmly. I would help you.
I know that. But Cephalo has no part in the decision.
Then why? Why must you do this?
The Veilman looked down.
The medicine that is needed for... Don't lie to me!
Eritrea dropped next to him on the well wall, her dark face angry.
Cephalo may believe that nonsense about roots and medicines, but he reads only the truth of your words, healer, and not the truth of your eyes.
You may disguise the first, but never the second.
This girl is not your sister. She is your charge, a responsibility that you clearly hold dear. It is not roots and medicines you seek, but something more.
What is it, then, that lies within the hollows? Will looked up slowly to meet her gaze and hold it. For a long moment he stared at her without replying. She reached out impulsively, her hands grasping his.
I would never betray you. Never.
He smiled faintly. Perhaps that is the one thing about which I am certain, Eritrea.
I will tell you this. There is a danger that threatens this land, that threatens all the lands. The thing that will protect against it can be found only in Safehold. Amberley and I have been sent to find it.
The rover girl's eyes were filled with fire.
Then let me go with you. Take me with you now, as you should have taken me before.
Will sighed.
How can I do that? You have just finished telling me that I am a fool for insisting on going into the hollows. Now you would have me treat you as a fool as well.
No. Your place is with your people, at least for now. Better that you continue east, far from the Westland and what may come.
Healer, I am to be sold by that devil who masquerades as my father the moment we reach the larger Southland cities.
Her voice was hard, brittle.
Am I to see myself as better off with that fate than any that you might encounter? Take me with you.
Eritrea, hear me out.
I know something of this country, for the rovers have traveled it since the time of my birth.
I may know something that could help you.
If not, at least I will be no hindrance to you. I can take care of myself, better than your elven girl. I ask nothing of you, healer, that you would not ask of me were our positions reversed. You must let me come.
Eritrea, even if I were to agree to this, Cephalo would never let you go.
Cephalo would not know until it was too late to do anything about it.
Her voice was quick and excited.
Take me with you, healer. Say yes to me.
He almost did. She was so wondrously beautiful that it would have been hard to refuse her anything under normal circumstances. But now, seated next to him, her eyes bright with anticipation, there was a desperation in her words that moved him. She was frightened of Cephalo and what he would do with her. She would not beg, the Veilman knew, but she would come as close to that as possible if it would persuade him to help her get free.
But the hollows were death, the old man had said. No one went into the hollows.
It would be difficult enough looking after Amberley, and despite what Eritrea had said about taking care of herself, Will knew that if she were permitted to come with them, he would worry for her just as he worried for the elven girl.
He shook his head slowly. I can't, Eritrea. I can't.
There was a long moment of silence as she stared at him, disbelief and anger shading her eyes, the excitement and expectation fading. Slowly she rose.
Though I have saved your life, you will not save mine.
Very well. She stepped back from him, tears streaking her face. Twice you have spurned me, Will Ormsford. You will not get the chance to do so again. She wheeled and started away, only to stop again a dozen paces on. There will come a time, healer, I promise you, when you will wish that you had not been so quick to refuse me aid. Then she was gone, lost in the night shadows as the veilman stared after her. He remained where he was for a time, wishing desperately that things might be different than they were, wishing that there were some sensible way that he might give to her the help she needed. Then at last he rose, the drowsiness growing, and stumbled off to sleep. Chapter 38. Dawn broke gray and sullen over the Wilderun, draping the forest land in shadows that spread like bloodstains across the dark earth. Clouds masked the morning sky, hanging still and deep over the valley, and an expectant hush filled the air, warning of the approach of a summer storm. Atop the ridgeline, Cephalo and his small band began their descent out of the hills, following the trail that would take them back down to the main roadway and a continuation of their journey toward the hollows. The rovers went from Hebel's camp as they had come, like shadows strayed, the horsemen leading the single wagon that bore Will and Amberley, hands raised in brief farewell to the old man who stood wordlessly before the little hut and watched them depart. Slowly they passed into the gloom of the forest, massive trees wrapping close about them until all but the faintest streamers of light were shut away, and there was nothing but the roadway, narrow and rutted and dark, burrowing down into the depths of the valley. By mid-morning they had reached the main road again and turned east. Mist began to gather on the valley floor, sifting through the trees as the day grew hot and the cool of the night turned to steam. Will and Amberley rode in silence with the old woman, thinking of what lay ahead. There had been no further conversations with Hebel, for they had slept soundly that night, and with their awakening, Cephalo had made certain that the old man had kept his distance from them. Now they found themselves wondering what more he might have told them had he been given the chance. As they pondered this, Cephalo rode back to speak with them, yet the smile and the conversation seemed forced and lacking any real purpose. He appeared several times more during the course of the morning, and each time it was the same. It was almost as if he were looking for something, yet neither Veilman nor Elven Girl had the slightest idea what it was that he might be seeking. Eretria stayed away from them entirely, and while Amberley was mystified as to the Rover Girl's sudden change in behavior, Will understood it all too well. It was nearing midday when Cephalo signaled a halt at a narrow crossroads somewhere deep within the forest. In the distance, thunder rumbled ominously and the wind blew in sudden gusts that shook the trees and scattered leaves and dust. Cephalo rode back to the wagon and stopped beside Will. "This is where we part company, healer," he announced. He pointed to the crossroads. "Your way lies south, down the smaller road. The path is clear. Simply stay on it. You should reach the rim of the hollows before nightfall." Will started to speak, and the rover quickly held up his hand. "Before you say anything, let me advise you not to ask that I go with you. That was not our bargain, and I have other obligations that I intend to satisfy." "I was about to ask you if we might have some provisions to take with us," Will informed him coolly. The rover shrugged. "Enough for a day or two. No more." He nodded to the old woman who stepped back through the door of the wagon. Will watched the rover shift uneasily in his saddle. Something was bothering Cephalo. "How will I find you to pay you your share of the reward?" he asked suddenly. "Reward? Oh, yes." Cephalo seemed to have forgotten it momentarily. "Well, as I said before, I will know when you have been paid. I will seek you out, healer." The veilman nodded, rose and stepped down from the wagon, then turned back to help Amberley. He glanced at her briefly as he lifted her down. She did not feel any easier about the rover's behavior than he did. He turned back to Cephalo.
Could you give us a horse? One would...
Cephalo cut him short. There are no horses to be spared. Now I think you should be going. There is a storm coming. The old woman reappeared and handed Will a small sack. The veilman slung it over one shoulder and thanked her. Then he glanced up at the rover once more.
A safe journey, Cephalo.
The big man nodded.
And a quick one to you, healer. Farewell.
Will took Amberley's arm and led her through the gathering of horsemen to the crossroads. Eretria sat astride her bay, black hair blowing wildly as the wind swirled past her. When the veilman reached her side, he stopped momentarily and extended his hand.
Goodbye, Eretria.
She nodded, her dark face expressionless, cold, and beautiful. Then, without a word, she rode back to join Cephalo. The veilman stared after her a moment, but she did not look at him again. He turned to the pathway leading south. Dirt blew into his eyes, and he shielded them with his hand, squinting into the gloom. With Amberley beside him, he started ahead. Hebel spent the morning at his workbench behind the little hut, hunched over a carving of a swamp cat. As he worked, his mind drifted back to the events of the previous night, to the elflings and their strange quest, and the warning he had given them, which they had ignored. He could not understand it. Why had they refused to heed him? Certainly he had made it clear enough that it was death to go into the hollows, and certainly he had made it clear as well that the domain of the witch sisters could not be violated. What was it then that could prompt this brother and sister to go there for nothing more than some obscure root medicine? Then it occurred to him that perhaps there was something more. He thought about that for a moment, and the more he thought about it, the more plausible it seemed. After all, they would not be so foolish as to entrust a rogue like Cephalo with the truth. No. Not that young man. He was too quick for that. Safe hold lay within the depths of Spire's reach. What sort of root would grow deep within a mountain where no sunlight could ever reach to nourish its growth? But magic had once been done within Safe Hold, the witch sister had whispered to him. Magic from another age, lost and forgotten. Did the elflings hope to discover it again? Overhead, the sky darkened further as the storm rolled out of the far country, the howl of the wind in the trees rising to a higher pitch. The old man paused in his work and looked up momentarily. This would be a big one, he thought idly. Another bad sign for those elflings who would be caught in the open, for the storm would overtake them before they reached the hollows. He shook his head. He would go after them if he thought it would do any good, but their minds were obviously made up. Still, it was too bad. Whatever they hoped to find within Safehold, be it root medicine or magic, they would have been better off to have forgotten it entirely. They would never live to use it. At his feet, Drifter lifted his shaggy head and sniffed the wind. Then abruptly the dog growled, low, deep, and angry. Hebel stared down at him curiously and glanced about. Shadows fell across the clearing from the forest trees, but nothing moved. Drifter growled again, and the hackles on the back of his neck rose. Hebel looked around guardedly. There was something out there, something hidden back in the gloom. He stood up, reaching for the broad axe. Cautiously, he started toward the trees. Drifter crouched beside him, still growling. But then he stopped. He did not understand why he stopped, except that suddenly he felt something cold slip into his body, chilling him so badly that he could barely stand. At his feet, Drifter lay on his belly and cried as if he had been struck, his great body cringing. The old man caught a glimpse of something moving, a shadow, massive and cloaked, there one moment and then gone. A fear passed through him, so terrible that he could not find the will to thrust it from him. It gripped him cruelly and held him fast as he stared helplessly at the dark forest and wished with everything that was left him that he might turn and flee. The axe fell from his hands and tumbled to the earth, useless. Then the feeling slipped from him, gone as quickly as it had come. All about him the wind howled, and a spattering of rain struck his leathery face. Drawing a deep breath, he reached down for the axe, and with Drifter close against him, backed slowly away until he felt his legs brush up against the workbench. He paused then, one hand gripping the neck of the big dog to keep himself from shaking. With frightening certainty, he knew that in 60 years of struggling to survive the dangers of the valley, never before had he come so close to dying. Will and Amberley had walked for less than an hour when the storm overtook them. A sprinkling of heavy drops that slipped teasingly through the dense canopy of trees turned quickly to a downpour. Sheets of rain swept across the pathway, driven by a west wind, and thunder boomed and reverberated through the sodden forest. Ahead, the gloom of the narrow trail darkened further with the rainfall, and water-laden tree limbs began to droop about them in damp trailers. They were soaked in minutes, bereft of the travel cloaks which they had failed to recover from the rovers along with the rest of their clothing. The light garments they had been fitted with in their stead clung to their bodies. There was nothing to be done that would ease their discomfort, however, so they simply put their heads down and walked on. For several hours the rain continued to fall at a steady pace, save for occasional brief lulls that gave false promise of an end to the storm. Through it all the Veilmen and the elven girl trudged on, water dripping from their bodies and their clothing, mud caking on their boots, their eyes fixed on the rutted path ahead. When at last the rain did slow and the storm moved eastward, mist began to seep out of the forest to mix with the deep gloom. Trees and brush shone dark and shiny through the haze, and water dripped noisily in the sudden stillness. Overhead the sky stayed clouded and dark. To the east, thunder rumbled, distant and lingering. The mist began to deepen, and the pace of the travelers slowed. It was then that the pathway began to slope downward, a slight dropping off that at first was barely perceptible, but gradually increased. Veilmen and elven girls slipped and skidded in the muddied earth as they followed it down, peering hopefully into the gloom ahead, yet finding nothing more than the dark tunnel of the road and the closure of the trees. The stillness had grown even more pronounced. Even the faint sounds of insects singing at the passing of the storm had faded into silence. Then suddenly, so suddenly that it was as if someone had removed a veil from before their eyes, the trees of the woods split apart, the slope dropped away, and the great dark bowl of the hollows lay spread before them. Veilmen and elven girl stopped where they were in the center of the muddied trail and stared down into the awesome expanse. They knew at once that they had found the hollows. This massive pit of black forest could be nothing else. It was as if they had come upon some monstrous dead lake, still and lifeless, its dark surface grown thick with vegetation so that what lay beneath its waters could only be guessed at. From its shadowed center rose spire's reach, a solitary column of rock thrusting up into the gloom, barren and pitted. The hollows were bleak like an open grave that whispered of death. The Veilmen and the elven girl stood silently upon the rim, fighting a sense of revulsion that grew with each passing moment that they gazed down into the soundless gloom. Nothing that either had ever encountered had looked so desolate. "We have to go down there," Will ventured finally, hating the idea. She nodded. "I know." He cast about hopefully for a way to proceed. Ahead the trail appeared to stop altogether. Yet when the veilman walked forward a bit, he saw that it did not end after all, but split to either side to wend downward into the shadows below. He hesitated a moment, studying the two paths, trying to decide which would provide the easier descent, then chose the one that ran left. He held out his arm to Amberley, and she gripped it firmly. Leading the way, he started down, feeling his boots slide as the damp earth and rock gave way in clumps. Amberley stayed close, leaning heavily on him for support. Cautiously, they moved ahead. Then abruptly, Will lost his footing and went down. Amberley fell with him, tripping forward across his legs, tumbling headlong from the muddied path to disappear with a sharp cry into the wooded darkness. Frantically, Will scrambled after her, pushing his way through heavy brush that ripped his clothing and cut his face. He might not have found the elven girl at all but for the bright silk of her rover clothing, a splash of red against the dark. She lay lodged against a clump of scrub, the breath knocked from her body, her face smeared with mud. Her eyes flickered uncertainly as he touched her.
Will?
He eased her into a sitting position, cradling her in his arms. Are you all right? Are you hurt?
No, I don't think so.
She smiled.
You're pretty clumsy, you know that.
He nodded, grinning with relief. Let's get you up. He put his arm about her waist and lifted her clear of the scrub, her small frame feather light as he set her back on her feet. Instantly she cried out and dropped back to the earth, reaching for her ankle.
It's twisted.
Will felt along the ankle, checking the bones. Nothing broken, just a bad sprain. He sat down beside her.
We can take a few moments to rest, then go on. I can help you down the slope. I can even carry you if it becomes necessary.
She shook her head.
Will, I am so sorry. I should have been more careful.
You? I was the one who fell. He grinned, trying to appear cheerful.
Well, maybe one of the old man's witch sisters will come along to help us out.
That is not funny. Amberley frowned. She looked about uneasily.
Maybe we should wait until morning to climb down any further. My ankle might feel better by then. Besides, even if we made it down before dark, we would have to spend the night there, and I don't much care to do that.
Will nodded.
Nor I. Nor do I think we should try to find our way about at night. Daylight will be soon enough. Maybe we should go back up to the rim.
She looked at him hopefully. The veilman smiled.
Do you really believe the old man's story? Do you think there are witches living down there?
She stared at him darkly.
Don't you?
He hesitated and then shrugged.
I don't know.
Maybe.
Yes, I guess so. There is very little I don't believe anymore.
He sat forward slowly, arms coming up about his knees.
If there are witches, I hope they are frightened of elfstones, because that is just about all the protection we have left.
Of course, if I have to use the stones in order to make them afraid, we may be in a lot of trouble.
I don't think so, she responded quietly. You still think I can use them, don't you? Even after what happened on the PyCon?
Yes,
but you shouldn't.
He looked at her.
You said something like that once before, remember? After the turfing, when we camped above the Myrmidon. You were worried for me. You said that I should not use the stones again, even if it meant saving you.
I remember.
Then later, when we fled the PyCon, I told you that I could no longer use the stones, that their power was lost to me, that my elven blood was not strong enough. You told me that I should not be so quick to judge myself, that you had confidence in me.
I remember that, too.
But look at what we have been saying. I think I should use the stones, but don't think I can. You think I can, but don't think I should. Funny, isn't it?
He shook his head.
And we still don't know which of us is right, do we?
Here we are, almost to Seyfeld, and I still haven't found out. He stopped suddenly, realizing what it was that he was saying. Well, it's not important, he finished, looking away. Better that we never find out. Better that they be given back to my grandfather. They were silent for a moment. Almost without thinking, Will reached into the rover tunic and lifted out the pouch that held the elf stones. He fingered it idly and was about to return it again when he noticed something odd about its feel. Frowning, he opened the drawstrings and dumped the contents into his open palm. He found himself staring at three ordinary pebbles. Will! Amberlee exclaimed in horror. The veilman stared at the pebbles in stunned silence, his mind racing. Cephalo, he whispered finally. Cephalo! Somehow he switched these for the stones. Last night, probably, while we slept. It had to be then. They were in the pouch that morning in Grimpen Ward. I checked. He rose slowly, still talking. But this morning I forgot. I was so tired last night. And you fell asleep almost at once. He must have drugged the ale to be certain I would not awake. No wonder he was so anxious to be rid of us. No wonder he made light of Hebel's warning about the hollows. He would be happy if we never came back. The reward meant nothing to him. It was the elf stones that he wanted all along. He started up the trail, his face livid. Then abruptly he remembered Amberlee. Turning quickly back, he lifted the elven girl in his arms, held her close against him, and scrambled back to the rim of the hollows. For a moment he looked about, then walked to a clump of high bushes several yards back. Stepping beneath the shelter of their boughs, he set the elven girl down. I have to go back for the elf stones, he declared quietly. If I leave you here, will you be all right? Will, you don't need the stones. He shook his head. If we have to test that theory, I would prefer that it be done with the stones in my possession. You heard what the old man said about the hollows? The stones are all that I have to protect you. Amberlee's face was white. Cephalo will kill you. Maybe. Maybe he has gotten so far up the trail by this time that I won't even get close to him. But Amberlee, I have to try. If I don't find him by dawn, I'll turn back, I promise. With or without the elf stones, I will be with you to go into the hollows. She started to say something more, but then stopped. Tears ran down her cheeks. Her hands lifted to touch his face. I care for you, she whispered. I really do. He looked at her in astonishment. Amberlee! Go on, she urged him, her voice breaking. Cephalo will have stopped for the night, and you may catch him if you hurry. But be careful, Will Ormsford. Do not give your life foolishly. Come back for me. She reached up to kiss him. Go. Quickly. He stared at her wordlessly for one instant more, then sprang to his feet. Without looking back, he ran from her and in seconds had disappeared into the forest gloom.
Chapter 39. At dawn of the same day that found Will and Amberlee faced with the disappearance of the elfstones, the demons attacked Arbalon. With a frightening shriek that shattered the morning stillness and reverberated through the lowland forests, they burst from the cover of the trees, a massive wave of humped and twisted bodies that stretched the length of the Carolan. In a frenzy that cast aside reason and thought, the creatures of the dark swept out of the gloom that was still thick within the shadowed woods and threw themselves into the waters of the Rillsong. Like a huge stain spreading over the water, they filled the river, large and small, swift and slow, leaping, crawling, shambling bodies surging and heaving through the swift current. Some swam the river's waters, thrusting and kicking to gain the far bank. Those light and fleet flew above, hopped upon, or skimmed over the river's surface. others so huge that they might walk upon the river's bottom, lunged awkwardly ahead, snouts and muzzles stretched high, bobbing and dipping. Many rowed crude boats and rafts, poling mindlessly into the river and grasping tightly at whomever or whatever came within reach, thus to be pulled to safety or carried to the bottom with that which had failed to give them aid. Madness gripped the demon horde, born of frustration with and hatred for the enemy that waited a scant few hundred yards away. This time, certainly, they would see that enemy destroyed. But the elves did not panic. Though the number, size, and ferocity of the demons who came at them might have broken the spirit of a less determined defender, the elves stood their ground. This was to be their final battle. It was their home city that they defended, the heart of the land that had been theirs for as long as the races had existed. All else had been lost now from the Rilsong West, but the elves were determined that they would not lose Arbalon. Better that they fight and die here, the last man, woman, and child of them, than that they be driven entirely from their homeland, outcasts in foreign lands, hunted like animals by their pursuers. Atop the battlements of the Elfich, Andor Elicidal watched the demon tide sweep forward. Alanon stood beside him. Neither man spoke. After a moment, Andor's eyes lifted. High overhead, a small dot appeared out of the clear blue of the dawn skies, growing in size as it circled downward until it took shape. It was Dane and his rock, Dancer. Downward they flew, gliding along the cliffs of the Carolan to settle finally on the open rampway above Andor and the Druid. Dismounting, Dane came hurriedly to where the Elven Prince waited. "How many?" Andor asked at once. Dane shook his head. "Even the woods and the mist can't hide them all. The ones we see before us are only a handful." Andor nodded. So many, he thought darkly. But Alanon had said it would be so. He refrained from looking at the Druid. "Do they seek to flank us, Dane?" The Wing Rider shook his head. "They come directly against the Carolan, all of them." He glanced down momentarily at the attacking demons as they struggled and thrashed in the waters of the Rilsong, then turned and started back toward the battlements. "I'll rest Dancer a few minutes more, then fly back for another look. Good luck, my Lord Prince." Andor barely heard him. "We must hold here," he murmured almost to himself. Already the struggle was underway. At the river's edge, row upon row of elven longbows hummed, and black shafts flew into the mass of heaving bodies that filled the waters of the Rilsong. Arrows bounced like harmless twigs from those armored with scales and leather hides, yet some found their mark, and the screams of their victims rose above the cries of attack. Dark forms twisted and sank into the boiling waters, lost in the wave of bodies that came after. Fire-tipped arrows thudded into the boats, rafts, and logs, but most were quickly extinguished, and the craft churned ahead. Again and again the archers shot into the advancing horde as it streamed out of the forest and into the river, but the demons came on, blackening the whole of the west bank and the river as they struggled to gain the elven defensive wall. Then a cry sounded from atop the Carolan, and cheers rang out. In the pre-dawn gloom, elves turned hurriedly to look, disbelief and joy reflecting in their faces, as a tall, gray-haired rider came into view. Down the length of the Elfich, the cry passed on from mouth to mouth. All along the front line of the Rilsong, behind the barricades and walls, it rose into the morning until it became a deafening roar. "Eventine! Eventine rides to join us!" In an instant's time, the elves were transformed, filled with new hope, new faith, new life. For here was the king who had ruled them almost 60 years, for many the whole of their lives. Here was the king who had stood against and finally triumphed over the warlock lord. Here was the king who had seen them through every crisis the homeland had faced. Wounded at Hallis Cut, seemingly lost, he was returned again. With his return, surely no evil, however monstrous, could prevail against them. Eventine. Yet something was wrong. Ander knew it the instant his father dismounted and turned to face him. This was not the Eventine of old, as his people believed. He saw in the king's eyes a distance separating the elven ruler from all that was happening about him. It was as if he had withdrawn into himself, not out of fear or uncertainty, for he could master those, but out of deep, abiding sadness that seemed to have broken his spirit. He looked strong enough, the mask of his face reflecting determination and iron will, and he acknowledged those about him with the old familiar words of encouragement. Yet the eyes betrayed the loss he felt, the despondency that had stripped him of his heart. His son read it there and saw that Alanon read it too. It was only the shell of the king riding forth that morning to be with his people. Perhaps it was the deaths of Arion and Pendannon that had done this. It might have been the injury he had suffered at Halas Cut, the defeat of his army there, or the terrible devastation of his homeland. But more probably it was all of these, and something more. The thought of failing, the knowledge that if the elves lost this battle they would allow an evil into the four lands that no one could stop and which would fall upon all the races and devour them. The responsibility for this must lie with the elves, yet with no man more than with Eventine, for he was their king. Ander embraced his father warmly, masking the sadness that he felt. Then he stepped back and held forth the Elkris staff. "This belongs to you, my lord." Eventine seemed to hesitate momentarily, then slowly shook his head. "No, Ander. It belongs to you now. You must carry it for me." Ander stared at his father wordlessly. He saw in the old man's eyes what he had missed before. His father knew. He knew that he was not well, knew that something within him was changed. The pretense he made to others was not to be made to his son. Ander withdrew the staff. "Then stand with me on the wall, my lord," he asked softly. His father nodded, and together they climbed the battlements. Even as they did so, the foremost of the demon horde gained the east bank of the Rilsong. Out of the river they surged, heaving up with savage cries to throw themselves against the lances and pikes that bristled from behind the elven bulwarks. In moments there were demons emerging from the river's dark waters along the entire length of the defensive line, horned and clawed, a jumble of limbs and jaws ripping and tearing at the defenders that barred their path. At its center, Stee Jans and the last of his free corps anchored the defense, the giant red-haired borderman standing at the forefront of his men, broadsword raised. On the flanks, Elrond Tay and Kerin of the Home Guard called out to their soldiers, "Hold, elven hunters, stand!" But finally, they could stand no longer. Outflanked and outnumbered, they saw their line begin to crumble. Huge demons thrust through the defenders and breached the low walls to open holes to those who followed. The waters of the Rilsong were dark with demon lifeblood and twisted bodies. But for every one that fell, still another three came on, a savage rush that no lesser force could hope to stop. Atop the gates of the second level of the Elfich, Ander gave the order to fall back. Quickly the elves and their allies abandoned the crumbling river wall and slipped into the forest behind, following carefully memorized paths to the safety of the ramp. Almost before the demons realized what was happening, the defenders were within its walls and the gates were shut behind them. Instantly the demons were in pursuit. Pouring through the forest at the base of the heights, they ran afoul of the hundreds of snares and pitfalls the elves had laid for them. For a few moments the entire rush stalled, but as their numbers increased upon the riverbank, they overran those caught within the traps and came onto the ramp of the Elfich. Massing quickly, they attacked. Up the walls of the first gate they charged, swarming atop one another until they were pouring over the defenses of the lower level. The elves were driven back. Almost before the gates to the second level could be closed, the first had fallen. Without slowing, the demons came on, scrambling up the ramp to the second gate. They swarmed along the walls and even up the rugged face of the cliff, clinging to the rock like insects. Bodies clawed, leaped, and bounded up the slope of the ramp and the bluff face, shrieking with hunger. The elves were appalled. The river had not stopped the demons. The defenses at the bank had been overrun in minutes. Now the first level of the Elfich had been lost, and even the cliff wall did not seem to slow them. It was beginning to look as if all their defenses would prove useless. Demon bodies thudded against the gates of the second ramp, clawing upward. Spears and pikes thrust down, impaling the attackers. The gates sagged on their hinges with the weight of the rush. Yet this time the defenders held, iron and sinew bracing the gates and repelling the attack. Cries of pain and death filled the air, and the demon force built into a mass of writhing forms, surging mindlessly against the walls of the ramp. Out of their midst came a handful of furies, lithe gray forms bounding atop the stone walls, cat women's faces twisted with hate. Elven defenders fell back from them, shredded by their claws, crying out in fear. Then Alanon's blue fire burst amid the furies, scattering them wildly. The elves counterattacked, throwing the cat things from the walls until the last had disappeared into the dark mass below. The druid and the Elicidals moved upward to the third gate. From there they watched as the demon attack gathered force. Still the elven defenders held, archers from the higher levels lending support to the lancers and pikemen below. Demons clung to the cliff face all about the ramp of the Elfich, working their way upward toward the heights in a slow, arduous climb. From atop the bluff, the dwarf sappers used longbows and boulders to knock the black forms loose. One after another, the demons fell, screaming and twisting to the rocks below. Then suddenly a monstrous demon rose out of the attackers that came at the gates of the second ramp, a scaled creature that stood upon its hind legs like a human, but had the body and head of a lizard. Hissing in fury, it threw its bulk against the gates, snapping the crossbars and loosening the hinges. In desperation, the elves sought to thrust it back, but the monstrous thing merely shrugged aside the blows, elven weapons snapping apart on its armored body. A second time it threw itself against the gates, and this time they split apart, shattering backward into the elves. The defenders fell back at once, fleeing up the Elfich to the third level where the next set of gates stood open to receive them. The lizard thing and its brethren followed after, pouring onto the rampway. For an instant it did not appear that the elves would succeed in closing the gates to the third ramp before the demons breached it. Then Stee Jans appeared at the entrance to the ramp, a huge spear gripped in his hands. Flanked by the veteran soldiers of the Free Corps and by Karen and a handful of Home Guard, he stepped in front of the advancing demons. Dropping forward in a crouch, the lizard demon reached for him. But the borderman was too quick. Sidestepping the monster's lunge, he thrust the great spear upward through the back of the gaping jaws. Hissing and choking, the lizard reared back on its hind legs, the shaft driven through its head. Clawed hands ripped at the Legion commander, but the men of the Free Corps and the elves rallied about him, warding off the blows. In seconds they were back within the safety of the battlements, the gates closing behind them. For an instant the lizard demon stood within the center of the ramp head, trying to pull free the killing shaft. Then its life was gone, and it fell backward into the midst of its brethren, sweeping them from the ramp as it tumbled over the wall and dropped to the forest below. Snarling, the demons renewed their attack, but their momentum had been lost. Strung out along the length of the Elfich, they could not seem to muster a sustained rush. The biggest among them had been slain. Lacking another to take his place, they milled uncertainly within the walls of the ramp below. Heartened by the courage of the Free Corps and their own Home Guard, the elven defenders beat them back. Arrows and spears cut into their midst, and hundreds of black forms collapsed upon the ramp. Still, the demons scrambled forward, but confused now and vulnerable. Ander recognized his opportunity. He gave the signal to counterattack. At Karen's order, the gates to the third ramp were thrown wide and the elves rushed forth. Into the mass of demons they charged, driving them back down the Elfich, back through the shattered gates of the second ramp. Sweeping clear the ramp, the defenders battled downward to the edge of the lower gates before the demons finally rallied. Back they came, reinforced by the thousands that still poured out of the Rillsong to the base of the cliff. The elves held a moment only, then retreated to the gates of the second level, bracing them anew with timbers and iron, and there they stood. So it went for the remainder of the day and into the evening. Back and forth along the rampway the battle raged, from the base of the bluff to the gates of the third level, elves and demons hacking and tearing at one another in a struggle where no quarter was asked and none given. Twice the demons retook the second set of gates and pushed up against the third. Twice they were driven back, once all the way to the base of the bluff. Thousands died, though the dead numbered highest among demons, for they fought without regard for life, spending themselves willingly on the defenders' carefully drawn formations. Yet elves were lost as well, injured and dead, and their numbers began to dwindle steadily, while the numbers of the demons never seemed to grow less. Then abruptly, without warning, the demons gave up the attack. Back down the length of the Elfich they went, not in flight nor in haste, but slowly, reluctantly, snarling and rasping as they faded back into the forests. Black forms huddled down in the shadowed gloom of night, crouched motionless and silent as if waiting for something to happen. Behind the gates and walls of the Elfich and from the rim of the Carolan, the exhausted defenders peered down into the dark. They did not question what had happened, but were merely grateful for it. For one more day, at least, the city of Arbelon was safe. That same night, scarcely 2 hours after the demons had withdrawn into the wooded blackness below the Carolan, a messenger came to Eventine and Ander as they met with the elven ministers in the High Council. In an excited voice he announced that an army of rock trolls had arrived from the Kershalt. Hurriedly, the king and his son emerged from the council building, the others trailing after to find the entire courtyard filled with row upon row of massive, bark-like forms, armored with leather and iron. Broadswords and spears glimmered in the smoky light of torches ringing the assemblage, and a sea of deep-set eyes fixed on the elves' astonished faces. Their commander stepped forward, a huge troll with a great two-edged axe strapped across his back. With a quick glance at the other elves, he placed himself before the king. "I am Amintar, Matarin of this army," he informed them, speaking in the rough troll dialect. "We are 1,500 strong, King Eventine. We come to stand with the elves." Eventine was speechless. They had all but given up on the trolls, believing that the Northlanders had chosen not to become involved in this conflict. Now, to find them suddenly here, just when it appeared that no more help would be coming. Amintar saw the old king's surprise. "King Eventine, you must know that much thought was given to your request for aid," he growled softly. "Always before trolls and elves have fought against one another, we have been enemies. That cannot be forgotten all at once. Yet for everyone there is a time to begin anew. That time has come for elf and troll. We know of the demons. There have been encounters with a scattering of them already. There have been injuries. There have been deaths. The rock trolls understand the danger that the demons pose. The demons are as great and evil as the warlock lord and the creatures of the Skullmark. Such evil threatens all. Therefore it is seen that elf and troll must put aside their differences and stand together against this common enemy. We have come, my countrymen and I, to stand with you. It was an eloquent statement. Amintar finished and, in a carefully measured gesture, dropped to one knee, signifying in the manner of the rock trolls his pledge of service. Behind him, his men followed him down, silent as they knelt before Eventine. Anders saw the tears that appeared suddenly in the old man's eyes. For that one moment, Eventine came all the way back from the place to which he had withdrawn, and there was hope and fierce pride in his face. Slowly he placed his right hand on his heart, returning the troll's pledge in the elven way. Amintar rose, and the two clasped hands. Ander found himself wanting to cheer. Alanon walked the narrow paths of the Gardens of Life beneath a clouded night sky through which moon and stars slipped like hunted things. Solitary, noiseless, his tall form passed through the cooling, fragrant blackness of the flowered tiers and sculpted hedges, head bent to the walk before him, arms gathered within the folds of the long dark robe. His hard face was lost within the shadow of the cowl, lean features etched with lines of worry and bitter resolve. For this night, he went to a meeting with death. He walked to the foot of the rise, ringed by the soldiers of the Black Watch. Impatient, he lifted his hand and slipped through them with the swiftness of a passing thought, and they did not see. Slowly he climbed to the top of the rise, not wishing to look at that which he had come to see, eyes lowered and fixed upon the grassy slope he trod. When at last he was atop the rise, his head lifted. Before him stood the Elkris, the once slender and graceful limbs withered and bent like the drying bones of some dead thing. Gone was the fragrance and the color, so that no more than a shadow remained of what had once been so incredibly beautiful. Blood-red leaves lay scattered upon the ground like wads of crumpled parchment. The tree stood bare, nailed against the night sky in a tangle of sticks and peeling bark. Alanon went cold. Even he had not been prepared for this, not for what he saw, nor for what he felt in seeing. Sorrow welled up within him at the inevitability of what was happening. He was powerless to prevent this, for even the druids lacked the gift of life eternal. All things must one day pass from the earth, and it was her time. His hand lifted to touch her withered limbs, then dropped again. He did not want to feel her pain. Yet he knew that he must have the measure of her, and he brought his hand up again, slowly, gently clasping. Just an instant he lingered, willing a sense of comfort and hope to flow from his mind into her own, then withdrew. Another day or two, perhaps three. No more. Then she would be gone. His tall form straightened, hands falling limply to his sides as his dark eyes fixed upon the dying tree. So little time. As he turned away, he wondered if that little time would be time enough to bring Amberlee back again. Chapter 40. Will Omsford raced back through the forest of the Wilderun, following the dark rut of the pathway as it tunneled ahead through mist and gloom. Trailing limbs and vines heavy with dampness brushed and slapped at him as he ran, and water splattered from puddles dotting the rain-soaked trail, leaving him streaked with mud. But the Veilman felt none of it, his mind crowded with emotions that spun and twisted to leave him dazed with despair at the loss of the Elfstones. Anger against Cephalo, fear for Amberlee, and wonderment at the words she had spoken to him. "I care for you," she had said, and meant it. "I care for you." So strange to hear her say such a thing to him. Once he would never have believed it possible. She had resented and mistrusted him. She had made that clear enough. And he had not really liked this elven girl. But the long journey they had begun in the village of Havenstead had taught them much about each other, and the dangers and hardships they had faced and overcome had brought them close. Their lives in that brief span of time had become inextricably bound together. It was not really so unexpected, then, that out of that binding should come some form of affection. The words throbbed in his head, repeating themselves. I care for you. She did, he knew, and wondered suddenly how much he, in turn, now cared for her. He lost his footing and went down, tumbling forward into the muck and the damp. Angrily he scrambled up, brushed the mud and water away as best he could, and ran on. The afternoon was waning far too rapidly. He would be fortunate just to regain the main roadway before nightfall set in. When that happened, he would have to find his way in total blackness, alone in an unfamiliar land, weaponless save for a hunting knife. Stupid. That was the kindest description he could render for what he had done, letting Cephalo fool him into thinking that he could have the rover's aid for nothing more than a vague promise. Clever Will Ohmsford, he chided himself, anger burning through him. And Elanon had thought that you were the one to whom he might safely entrust Amberley. Already his muscles were beginning to cramp with the strain of running. Despair washed through him for a moment as he thought of all that Amberley and he had endured to reach this point, only to face losing everything for want of a bit more caution. 7 elven hunters had given their lives so that he and Amberley might reach the Wilderun. Countless more would have already died defending the Westland against the demons, for surely the forbidding had given way by now. All for nothing, then? All to no end but this? Shame and then determination rushed through him, carrying away the despair. He would never give up. Never. He would retrieve the stolen elfstones. He would return to Amberley. He would see her safely to Spire's Reach, to the Bloodfire, and back once more to Arbalon. He would do all this because he knew that he must, because to do anything less would be to fail. Not just Alanon and the elves, but himself as well. He was not about to do that. Even as the thought passed from his mind, a shadow appeared on the trail ahead, materializing out of the gloom like some wraith, tall and silent as it awaited his approach. The veilman drew up short, frightened so badly that he very nearly bolted from the pathway into the forest. Breathing raggedly, he stared at the shadow, realizing suddenly that what he was looking at was a horse and rider. The horse shifted on the trail and stamped. Will walked forward cautiously, wariness turning to disbelief and finally to astonishment. It was Eretria. Surprised? Her voice was cool and measured. Very, he admitted. I have come to save you one last time, Will Ohmsford. This time, I think, you will hear better what I have to say. Will came up to her and stopped. Cephalo has the stones. I know that. He drugged your wine, then took them from you last night while you slept. And you did nothing to warn me? Warn you? She shook her head slowly. I would have warned you, healer. I would have helped you. But you would not help me, remember? All that I asked of you was that you take me with you when you left. Had you done that, I would have told you of Cephalo's plans for the Elfstones, and would have seen to it that you kept them safe. But you spurned me, healer. You left me. You thought yourself able to manage well enough without me. Very well, I decided. I will see how well the healer does without me. She bent down to examine him, her eyes appraising. It does not appear that you are doing too well. Will nodded slowly, his mind racing. This was no time to say something foolish. Amberley is hurt. She fell and twisted her leg and cannot walk alone. I had to leave her at the rim of the hollows.
You seem very good at leaving women in distress, Eretrius snapped. He held his temper. I guess it must appear that way. But sometimes we cannot always do what we want when it comes to helping others. So you have said. I guess that you must believe it. Have you left the elven girl, then? Only until I get the stones back again. Which you won't without me. Which I will, with or without you. The rover girl stared down at him for a moment, and her face softened. I guess you believe that, too, don't you? Will put his hand on the horse's flank. Are you here to help me, Eretria? She regarded him wordlessly for a moment, then nodded. If you, in turn, will help me. This time you must, you know. When he did not respond, she continued speaking. A trade, Will Ormsford. I will help you get back the stones if you will agree to take me with you when you have them back again. How will you get the stones back? He asked carefully. She smiled for the first time, that familiar, dazzlingly beautiful smile that took his breath away. How will I do it? Healer, I am the child of rovers and the daughter of a thief, bought and paid for. He stole them from you. I will steal them from him. I know the trade better than he. All we need do is find him. Won't he be wondering about you by now? She shook her head. When we parted company with you, I told him that I wished to ride ahead to join the caravan. He agreed that I could, for the paths of the Wilderun are well known to the rovers, and I would be clear of the valley by nightfall. As you know, healer, he wants to be certain that he keeps me safe. Damaged goods bring a poor price. In any case, I rode but a mile beyond Whistle Ridge, then took a second trail that cuts south and joins this one several hundred yards further back. I thought to catch up to you by nightfall, either at the hollows or coming back this way, should you discover sooner the loss of the stones. So you see, Cephala will not realize what I have done until he reaches the main caravan. The wagon slows him, so he will not do that until sometime tomorrow. Tonight, he will camp on the road leading out of the valley. Then we have tonight to get back the stones, Will finished. Time enough, she replied. But not if we continue to stand here and talk about it. Besides, you don't want to leave the elven girl alone at the hollows for very long, do you? The mention of Amberley jarred him. No, let's be off. One moment. She backed the horse away from him. First, your word. Once I have helped you, then you will help me. You will take me with you when we have the stones back. You will let me stay with you after that until I am a safe distance from Cephalo. And I will decide when that is the case. Promise me, healer. There was very little else that he could do short of taking her horse from her, and he was not at all sure that he could do that. Very well. I promise. She nodded. Good. To see that you keep that promise, I will keep the stones once I have taken them back again, until we are both safely out of this valley. Climb up behind me. Will mounted the horse without comment. There was no way that he was about to let her keep the elf stones once she had retrieved them from Cephalo, but it was pointless to argue about it here. He settled himself behind the girl and she turned to look at him. You do not deserve what I am doing for you, you know that. But I like you. I like your chances in life, especially with me to aid you. Put your hands about my waist. Will hesitated, then did as he was told. Eretria leaned back into him. Much better, she purred seductively. I prefer you this way to the way you are when the elven girl is about. Now hold tight. With a sudden yell, she put her boots into the flanks of the horse.
The startled beast reared up with a scream and shot back along the pathway. Down the wilderness trail they rode, bent low across the horse's neck, limbs whipping against them as they flew through the dark. Eretria seemed to have the eyes of a cat, guiding their mount with a sure and practiced hand past fallen logs and deadwood, over gullies and ruts formed by the sudden rain, down one muddied slope and up the next. Will hung on desperately, wondering if the girl had lost her mind. At this pace, they were certain to take a fall. Amazingly, they did not. Scant seconds later, Eretria wheeled their horse from the trail through a narrow gap in the trees that was all but completely grown over. With a surge, the animal sprang into the brush, then broke free along a second trail, one that Will had missed completely in his trek south to the hollows, and galloped ahead into the misty gloom. On they rode, Rover, Girl, and Veilman, barely slowing for the obstacles that barred their path forward, racing ahead into the growing dark. What little light there was had begun to fade as dusk approached. The sun, lost somewhere beyond the canopy of the forest, sank downward toward the rim of the mountains. Shadows deepened and the air cooled, and still Eretria did not slow. When at last they did stop, they were back once more on the main roadway. Eretria reined the horse in sharply, patted the animal's sweating flanks, and glanced back at Will with an impish grin.
"That was just to let you know that I can hold my own with anyone. I need no looking after from you."
The Veilman felt his stomach begin to settle.
"You have made your point, Eretria. Why are we stopping here?"
"Just to check," she replied, and dismounted. Her eyes scanned the trail for a few moments, and then she frowned.
"That's odd. There are no wagon tracks."
Will followed her down.
"Are you sure?"
He studied the roadway, finding no sign of wheel marks.
"Maybe the rain washed them out."
The wagon was heavy enough that the rain should not have washed away all traces of its passing. She shook her head slowly.
"Besides, the rain would have been nearly ended by the time it reached this point."
"I don't understand it, healer." The light was growing steadily dimmer. Will glanced about apprehensively.
"Would Cephalo have stopped to wait out the storm?"
"Maybe." She looked doubtful.
"We had better backtrack a bit. Climb on."
They remounted and began riding west, glancing from time to time at the muddied earth for some sign of the Rover wagon. There was nothing. Eretria urged their mount into a slow trot. Ahead, mist curled out of the forest on either side, thin, wispy trailers that slipped like feelers through the gloom. Night sounds came from deep within the trees as the creatures of the valley awoke and began to hunt. Then a new sound rose from somewhere ahead, faint at first, lingering like an echo in the midst of the sharper, quicker sounds, then stronger and more insistent. It grew into a howl, high-pitched and eerie, as if such pain had been inflicted upon some tortured soul that the limits of endurance had been passed, and all that was left before death was that final, terrible cry of anguish. Will gripped Eretria's shoulder in alarm.
"What is that?"
She glanced back.
"Whistle Ridge, just ahead."
She grinned nervously. "The wind makes that sound sometimes." It grew worse, a harsher, more biting cry, and the land began to rise through the forest in a rocky slope that took them above the mist, the trees parting to reveal small patches of blue night sky. The horse had begun to respond to the sounds, huffing nervously, dancing and shifting as Eretria sought to calm it. They moved more slowly now, edging ahead through the dusk until they were atop the ridgeline. Beyond, the roadway straightened once more and disappeared into the gloom. Will saw something then, a shadow moving toward them, materializing out of the howl of the wind and the night. Eretria saw it as well and reined in sharply. The shadow came closer. It was a horse, a big sorrel, riderless, its reins trailing in the earth. It came slowly up to them and rubbed noses with their own mount. Both Veilman and Rover Girl recognized it at once. It was Cephalo's. Eritrea dismounted, handing the reins of her own horse to Will. Wordlessly, she examined the sorrel, walking quickly about it, patting its flanks and neck to keep it calm. There were no marks on the animal, but it was sweating heavily. When she glanced again at Will, Eritrea's dark face was uncertain. Something has happened. His horse would not stray. The Veilman nodded. He was beginning to get a very bad feeling about this. Eritrea climbed atop Cephalo's horse and took up the reins. We will go on a bit further, she decided, but there was doubt in her voice. Side by side they rode along the ridgeline, the wind whistling its eerie cry through the high rock and the trees of the forest. Overhead the stars winked into view, pale white light shining down into the dark of the Wilderun. Then something else appeared through the gloom, another shadow, this one black and squarish and motionless upon the trail. Veilman and Rover Girl slowed, easing their horses ahead cautiously, uneasiness reflecting in their eyes. Gradually the shadow began to take shape. It was Cephalo's wagon, the garish colors caught in the starlight. They rode closer, and uneasiness then turned to horror. The team of horses that had pulled the wagon was dead, twisted and broken, still locked in their leather and silver-studded traces. Several more of the animals lay close by, and with them their riders, scattered on the trail like straw men, torn and crumpled, bright clothing stained with blood that seeped through the fabric to mix with the muddied earth. Quickly Will looked about, peering into the shadows of the forest, searching for some sign of the thing that had done this. Nothing moved. He glanced at Eritrea. She sat rigid on her mount, the color draining from her face as she stared fixedly at the bodies on the trail. Her hands dropped slowly to her lap and the reins slipped free. Will dismounted, scooped up the fallen reins, and tried to hand them back to the frightened girl. When Eritrea did not move to take them, he gripped her hands, placed the reins of both horses between her fingers, and forced them closed. She glanced down at him wordlessly. "Wait here," he ordered. He walked toward the wagon, studying the twisted forms about him as he went. All lay dead, even the old woman who had driven the wagon, bodies broken like deadwood. The Veilman felt his skin crawl. He knew what had done this. One by one he checked them until at last he found Cephalo. The big man was dead as well, his tall form stretched full length upon the ground, forest green cloak shredded, angular features frozen with a look of horror. So ruined was his body that it was nearly impossible to recognize. Will bent down. Slowly he felt through the dead rover's clothing, searching for the elf stones. He found nothing. Fear knotted his stomach. He had to find the stones. Then he noticed Cephalo's hands. The right hand clutched at the earth in a gesture that spoke of unbearable agony. The left was flung wide and closed into a fist. The Veilman took a deep breath and reached for the left. One by one, he pried open the rigid fingers. Blue light winked from between them, and relief flooded through him. Embedded in the flesh of the palm lay the elf stones. Cephalo had sought to use them as he had seen Will do in the Tirfing, but the stones had not responded to the rover, and he had died still clutching them. The Veilman pulled them free of the dead man's grip, wiped them on his tunic, and dropped them back into their leather pouch. Then he rose, listening to the shriek of the wind whistling through the ridge. Dizziness washed over him as the smell of death filled his nostrils. Only one thing could have done this. He remembered the elven dead at the camp at Dray Wood and in the fortress of the Pycon. Only one thing. The Reaper. But how had it found them again? How had it trailed them all the way from the Pycon to the Wilderun? He steadied himself and hastened back to Eretria. She still sat astride Cephalo's horse, dark eyes bright with fear.
"Did you find him?" she asked in a whisper. "Cephalo."
Will nodded.
"He's dead. They're all dead."
He paused.
"I took back the stones."
She did not seem to hear him.
"What kind of thing could do this, healer? Some animal, maybe? Or the witch sisters, or—"
"No." He shook his head quickly. "No, Eretria, I know what did this. The thing that did this tracked Amberlee and me all the way south from Arbalon. I thought that we had lost it on the other side of the Rockspur, but somehow it has found us again." Her voice shook.
"Is it a devil?"
"A special kind of devil." He glanced back at the dead upon the trail.
"They call it a reaper."
He thought a moment. "It must have believed we were traveling with Cephalo. Perhaps the rain confused it. It followed after him and caught him here."
"Poor Cephalo," she murmured.
"He played one game too many." She paused and glanced back at him sharply.
"Healer, this thing knows now that you did not come east with Cephalo. Where will it go next?"
Veilman and Rover Girl stared wordlessly at each other. Both knew the answer. At the rim of the hollows, Amberlee crouched within the shelter of the bushes where Will had hidden her and listened to the sounds of the night. Darkness lay over the Wilderun like a shroud, deep and impenetrable, and the elven girl sat locked within it, unable to see beyond the covering brush, hearing the creatures that prowled the gloom. Knowing that it would be dawn before Will could return to her, she tried for a time to sleep. But sleep would not come. Her ankle pained her, and her mind crowded with the thoughts of the Veilman and his quest, of her grandfather, of the dangers all about her. At last, she gave it up. With her knees pulled up against her body, she hunched forward, determined that she would become as nearly as she could a part of the forest about her, still, motionless, and unseen. For a time, she succeeded. None of the forest creatures ventured near her, staying back within the deep woods, back from the rim of the hollows. The hollows themselves lay wrapped in a silence so profound that the elven girl could hear it as clearly as she heard the sounds of the night. Once or twice, something flew past her shelter, the quick flap of wings breaking the stillness briefly, then fading once more. Time slipped away, and she began to nod sleepily. Then the chill swept through her suddenly, as if the warmth had been sapped from the air about her. She came awake and rubbed her arms briskly. The chill left, and the heat of the summer night slipped back across her. Uncertain now, she glanced about her shelter. Everything was as it had been before. In the darkness, nothing moved, nothing sounded. She took a deep breath and closed her eyes again. The chill came back. She waited this time before moving, keeping her eyes tightly shut, trying to trace the source of the chill. She discovered that it came from somewhere within herself. She did not understand. Cold, bitter cold within her, pushing through her, numbing like the touch of death. Her eyes snapped wide. Instantly she understood. She was being warned, how she did not know, that something was going to kill her. Had she been anyone but who she was, she might have ignored the feeling as being nothing more than the workings of her imagination. But she was highly sentient. Such feelings had come over her before, and she knew better than to dismiss them. The warning was real. It was only the source that confused her. She hunched forward in momentary indecision. Something was coming for her, something monstrous, something that would destroy her. She could not hide from it. She could not stand against it. She could only run. Ignoring the pain in her ankle, she slipped from beneath the bushes, crouched down beyond them, and stared into the forest gloom. The thing that stalked her was close. She could sense its presence clearly now as it moved soundlessly through the night. She thought suddenly of Will, and she wished desperately that he were there to help her. But Will was not there. She must save herself, and she must do so quickly. There was only one place for her to go, one place that her stalker might not follow. The hollows. She hobbled to their edge and stared down into the depthless black. Fear gripped her. The hollows were as frightening to her as the thing behind. She steadied herself, green eyes sweeping across the black to the Tower of Spire's reach. It was there that she must go. It was there that Will would look for her. She found a pathway leading down and started along it, easing carefully into the shadows. In moments, she was enveloped by the blackness. The light of the stars and moon were lost above the trees. Her child's face tightened with determination, and she felt her way forward. She kept as still in her movements as she was able, and there was only the slight scraping of her boots on earth and rock to betray her passage. Below, there was only silence. At last, she was on the floor of the hollows. She paused then, sitting back against a tree trunk, rubbing gingerly the injured ankle. It was badly swollen by now, aggravated by her decision to walk upon it. Sweat bathed her face as she stared upward into the gloom and listened. She heard nothing. No matter, she told herself. Whatever it was that sought her, it was up there still, searching. She had to get deeper into the hollows. Her eyes had begun to adjust to the blackness. She could discern vaguely the shapes of trees and clumps of brush about her. It was time to go on. She pushed herself up and hobbled ahead into the dark, trying to keep her weight off her injured ankle. Moving from one tree to the next, she rested a moment at each, listening anxiously to the deep silence. The pain was growing worse, a steady throb that seemed to intensify with each step forward. The muscles of her good leg had stiffened and cramped with the constant hobbling. Already, she was beginning to tire. Finally, she had to stop. Breathing heavily, she lowered herself to the ground beside a thicket and leaned back against the cooling earth. Carefully, she composed herself and tried to trace anew the source of the warning. For a moment, nothing happened. Then the chill swept back across her, penetrating, biting. She caught her breath. The thing that sought her was within the hollows. She hauled herself back to her feet and went on, limping blindly through the gloom. At one point it occurred to her that she might be traveling in a circle, but she pushed the thought quickly from her mind. She fell constantly. Several times she went down so hard that she nearly blacked out. Each time she came to her knees, gasping for breath, rose and forced herself to go forward. The minutes slipped by until she lost all track of time. About her, the silence and the dark deepened. At last, she could go no further. She fell to her knees, the sound of her breathing harsh in her ears. Crying with frustration, she began to crawl. Rock and deadwood scraped at her hands and knees as she worked her way through the brush, her ankle throbbing with pain. She would not give up, she swore silently. The thing would not have her. She turned her thoughts to Will. She saw in her mind the look that had crossed his face when she told him that she cared for him. She should not have said it, she knew. But she had wanted to tell him so badly at that moment. She had needed to tell him. It surprised her how much she had needed to tell him. And the wonder in his eyes. She collapsed on her face, weeping. Will! She whispered his name like a talisman to ward off the evil that stalked her through the blackness. Then she lifted herself and crawled on. Her mind wandered, and she seemed to sense the presence of other creatures about her, moving with her through the night,
quick and all but soundless. Little people, she thought. But the thing. Where was the thing? How close to her was it? She crawled and crawled until her strength was gone entirely. Then she lay down upon the forest earth. She was finished, she knew. She had nothing left to draw upon. Her eyes closed and she waited to die. A moment later, she slept. She was still sleeping when the crooked wooden fingers of a dozen gnarled hands lifted her up and bore her away.
Chapter 41. The Veilman and the Rover girl rode down the rock-strewn trail and off Whistle Ridge, the wind whistling past their ears. Into the blackness of the lower forest they flew, Rover silks whipping about their bodies as they bent low across their horses' necks and peered blindly into the gloom. The trees quickly closed about them and the night sky disappeared. With reckless disregard for their lives, they rode on, trusting to the sure-footedness of their mounts and to luck. There was no discussion of this. They had no time for discussion. The instant that Will realized that the Reaper would backtrack until it found the trail Amberlee and he had taken south to the Hollows after parting company with the Rovers, his mind went blank to every thought but one. Amberlee would be at the end of that trail, alone, injured, and unprotected. If he did not reach her before the Reaper did, she would die, and it would be his fault because it had been his decision to leave her. An image of the torn and broken bodies of the Rovers on the trail flashed in his mind. At that moment he forgot everything but his need to get to Amberlee. Scrambling back atop his horse, he wheeled the animal about and galloped away. Eritrea gave chase immediately.